Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got another packed show, so let's get going. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about the situation of Iran's political prisoners. Nahid Taghavi, who we talked about a couple of months ago, faces trial on June 13th. I'm going to replay an interview I did a few months back with Maryam Claren, Nahid's daughter. Right before that interview, we'll hear from Dali Veal of the Emergency Campaign to Free Iran's Political Prisoners. Opening the show up, we'll be talking about a march on June 12th. Show the world we are getting organized now for revolution, nothing less. The main march will be in Los Angeles, and there will be solidarity actions in other cities. Go to revcom.us for information. In Los Angeles, the sheriff, a mini-Trump fascist named Villanueva, threatened the march by denying a permit. After a petition that was signed by a number of prominent people, the sheriff lost and granted a permit. We'll hear the press conference in front of the sheriff's station in South Central Los Angeles, talking about the June 12th march and the importance of standing up for the right to protest. This press conference happened before the sheriff caved on the permit. So let's hear Michelle Chai, spokesperson for the Los Angeles Revolution Club, who will introduce Noche Diaz.
Okay, so welcome everybody. My name is Michelle Chai. I'm with the Revolution Club here in Los Angeles. And we're here today in front of the LA County Sheriff's Station because they have denied our permit to march and show the world that we are getting organized now for revolution, nothing less. This march will be taking place on June 12th at 2 p.m., marching from Southwest College through this neighborhood and ending up here at the sheriff's station. In an arbitrary act, our legal permit to march was denied by the LA County Sheriffs. This march will go forward. We demand this denial be reversed. Sheriff Alex Villanueva states that this sheriff's station, quote, does not have a sufficient number of patrol duties without inhibiting normal police protection for the rest of the unincorporated regions nearby, unquote. And that, quote, past demonstrations within the last year at South LA Station became unruly, which ultimately resulted in injury to persons and property, unquote. First of all, let's talk about who were the unruly ones. These sheriffs who murdered Andres Guardado, Dijon Kizzy, in the wake of George Floyd being murdered. People righteously took to the streets to denounce these murders by the police. These protests were met with vicious brutality. The sheriffs tear gassed legally assembled protesters, including young children. They shot rubber bullets aimed at injuring protesters, aiming for people's groins, hands, and faces, and arrested dozens of people. Second, the basic right of the Revolution Club to deliver this urgent political message is not dependent on how many cops they can dispatch to direct traffic. In a letter signed by a number of people, some who you will hear from today, states, quote, this constitutional violation cannot stand and must be reversed. We are especially concerned the LA sheriffs, who have a long history of violence against political demonstrators, are deliberately creating a dangerous situation for this protest. Such unconstitutional repression is unacceptable. This letter is here available for you to take and has been signed by a number of people, including Robin D.G. Kelly, professor at history at UCLA, Jim Lafferty, who is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, the LA chapter, people here, including Reverend Nathaniel Martin, who is the president of the LA chapter of the National Action Network, Sequoia McCoy, who is the aunt of Dijon Kizzy, Professor Arturo O'Farrell, Global Jazz Studies at UCLA, Reverend Cecil Murray, former pastor of the First AME Church in Los Angeles, civil rights activist, Joe Veal, former member of the Black Panther Party and part of the national tour to get organized for an actual revolution, Cornel West, Alyssa Milano, who's an actress, and Shepard Ferry, who's an artist. We're going to hear from a number of people today, some who have signed this letter. And we're going to start with Noche Diaz, who is a spokesperson for the Revolution Club.
Okay, I want to start off by taking off my mask. I'm Noche Diaz. I'm a national spokesperson for the Revolution Clubs. I want to start off by expressing my appreciation for those who have come, who have been part of signing this statement demanding a reversal of this denial of the permit. Reverend Wolf, Reverend Nathaniel, Emmanuel, and all the other people who have signed this letter that's been sent. And I want to say a couple things about June 12th. What is the message? What is the method that's got these sheriffs all shooketh? June 12th, we're going to be starting at South LA College on Western and Imperial. We're going to be marching through this neighborhood and ending at this sheriff's station. This march is open to everyone who wants to see a different world. Everyone who cannot stand the way things are and have the heart to fight for something worth fighting for. What we have already heard about these sheriffs, the murder of Dejan Kizzee and Andre Guardado, and the other 300 people that they have killed over the last 21 years. The day in, day out terror that they inflict on the people in this neighborhood who describe feeling as if they're going through their lives hunted like animals. This would be reason enough for us to be marching on June 12th. To demand revolution, nothing less, to show the world that we are getting organized for revolution, nothing less. Unfortunately, though, it is not the only reason we are marching. The fact is that today, very literally, we can say there may be no future at all, and there is certainly no future worth living if we continue to live under this system. But on June 12th, we'll be marching these streets to show everyone that there is a purpose and a future worth living and fighting for. Revolution, nothing less. On June 12th, we will not be marching here to beg these oppressors to murder us a little bit less or to be a little bit nicer as they carry out their oppression and terror. We won't be doing that because we understand, and people more broadly need to understand, that these sheriffs and the police just like them, not only in this city but across this country, and the military of the United States around the world, enforce a system of capitalism, imperialism, of oppression and madness here and throughout the world. People need to understand that, and people need to be, and people need to see a force that is fighting for a whole different world. A future without white supremacy, male supremacy, the demonization of immigrants, the wars for empire, and the destruction of the environment and the planet we live on. People need to become, and people need to see a force that is preparing, that is building up strength and organizing forces for a time when millions can go up against this system, bring it down through a revolution, and dismantle and defeat the violent instruments and tools that enforce this system. We'll be marching on June 12th through these streets to show people we don't have to look to and follow the leaders that are trotted out in front of us that keep us playing around for centuries with changes that only help a few while keeping this whole thing going. We'll be letting people know there is leadership to look to and follow if you want to get free. And that's Bob Avakian, who's got a way to end all this madness. Recently, Bob Avakian commented on the 100-year anniversary of Tulsa, Oklahoma, the white racist riot and massacre of black people in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And looking at that incident and the whole history of this country, Bob Avakian said, the question is not if this whole system needs to go, it's how soon can we get rid of it. And June 12th, we're bringing those days closer. June 12th, we'll be marching these streets because people need to be and people need to see a force that is getting ready to actually get rid of this system. And this is totally legal. What we are doing June 12th is not only legal, it's very needed. We are training people now to be a disciplined and determined force. to not get provoked into foolishness that these sheriffs will try to start. We are training people to be disciplined and determined to not back down or back off from this goal of emancipating all of humanity. As our points of attention in the Revolution Club say, number 6, we are serious about an actual overthrow of this system and a whole better way beyond all the destructive and vicious conflicts of today. And because we are serious, at this stage, we do not initiate violence. And we oppose all violence against the people and among the people. And I say this because the reason that these sheriffs have given to deny us a permit for June 12th are ridiculous. The idea that they don't have enough resources and police to police people to allow them to be able to speak out is ridiculous on its face. It's embarrassing to even talk about here. And 2, the idea that over this last year, they talk about unruly, how unruly these protests were. Let me tell you about unruly and how people and property were destroyed. Dejan Kizzy was murdered, first of all. And people who came out to protest the violence of these sheriffs were met with more brutality and more terror. A comrade in the Revolution Club was urinating blood for days after marching in these streets and being hit with rubber bullets and attacked by these police. And for them to be able to declare any protest against their violence as unlawful assembly, to attack it the way they did, and then to use their violence to declare that people don't have the right to march the streets anymore, is not just hypocrisy, it is deadly fascist logic that we all need to oppose. Nobody should accept this bunch of unruly, out-of-control, white supremacist, gang-infested L.A. sheriffs determining who gets the right to march around.
Here, here. That's right.
Nobody should accept a future that people like that are trying to bring into being where people's rights are shredded or essentially made meaningless by this kind of circular logic of an open dictator and oppressor. And we, all of us, should refuse to accept slavery in any form and be getting organized to put an end to all oppression. And June 12th, that is why we're gonna be marching in the streets. That is why this permit should be, because we're not just gonna be in a corner somewhere or giving them excuses to attack people who march when they see people who they brutalize every day marching in the streets together with people from all over the city and demanding a whole different world. We can't allow them to use any excuse or pretense to attack that. When people are already beaten down so much already, when they lift their heads, everyone should be at their side and at their back and say, we are standing together. And this march should go through these streets. And we should be loud. And we should have our truck. And we should take the streets.
Hear, hear. Right.
So June 12th, this is the message. This is what we are doing. And this is why we demand a reversal of the decision to deny the permit to the Revolution Club marching on June 12th. This is why we express our appreciation and thanks for everyone who has stood together with us in demanding a reversal of this decision. Not just for our right to speak, but for what kind of future and what kind of society and what kind of means we're going to have available to even fight for a different world. Thank you, sisters and brothers. And others. Right.
That was Michelle Chai and Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club. Next, we'll hear remarks from Reverend Nathaniel Martin and then Reverend Frank Wolf, who will be introduced by Michelle Chai.
So next up, I want to bring up Reverend Nathaniel Martin, who is the LA Action Network president.
No justice. I'm the president of the National Action Network, LA chapter, and I'm proud to stand with this organization, this revolutionary club, because we are all in this fight of social justice together because of the fact that the Constitution, First Amendment, opened and said Congress shall make no law touching any establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Neither, it goes further to talk about denying the freedom of the press, then it mentions the right of assembly. And that is why we're here today, because of the denial by this fascist sheriff's department, this racist sheriff's department, that has historically oppressed the voice of the people, not only here in LA County, but all across the nation. I don't have to remind you that it was Commissioner William Bratton who said some years ago that some of the worst experiences of black people in America would not have been possible without the help of the police department. And if you go back all the way through slavery, which is where the police department started here in America, we don't talk about that, all the way up to now, it has always been the tip of the spear for those that oppress the people. And when you try to deny the people the right to speak out in an assembly, peaceful assembly, as was done or as is trying to be done by the LA County Sheriff's Department under Sheriff Villanueva, who should be recalled, then you're really slapping all of us in the face, because all of us need to be out protesting and assembling to address the need for systemic change, not only here in LA County, but all the way across this country. I think I'm preaching to the choir, but we must make our voices heard. Somebody who said that those who make peaceful protests impossible make violent protests inevitable. So we are working toward a better country, a better nation, a better society. It's time to end the policing practices that have been the bedrock of policing in this city since slavery. Most of you were not here under Chief Parker, who trained most of the police and all the practices that I looked at as a child on Dragnet. We come to find out that none of that was true. It was all a lie. And so the principal oppressor of the people has always been the tip of the spear, which has been the police department. And it's time for all of us to join together with other brother and sister organizations to end, change, redirect, come up with new policies for law enforcement, not only here, but all across this nation. Otherwise, another generation will be standing out here marching for the death of Ms. Kissing, standing out here marching for the death of Mr. Guardado, standing out here marching, trying to get the sheriff's knee off of the collective neck of the people of the society. And it is time for that to come to an end. And so I join with my brothers and my sisters in this protest, in this speaking out, in this just expression of rage when the people's voice is being muffled and muzzled by the police authority. Power to the people!
All right, thank you, Reverend Martin. So I want to bring up Reverend Frank Wolf, who is the pastor of the Echo Park United Methodist Church.
I'm here today because it doesn't matter whether you're a member of the Revolution Club or not. Well, it does matter, but but when it comes down to the question of whether or not this march should take place, if you're a person of goodwill, if you're a person who cares about justice, if you're a person who cares about what's right in this world, then this march needs to be allowed to take place. And those people who are saying that it can't take place are coming up with false narratives about what's inevitably going to go wrong because they're going to make it go wrong. Those people need to be told up front that they cannot have this kind of power. To be honest with you, I don't know why the police and sheriff get to decide who gets a permit. Why is it their job? right? Especially when the protest is against the violence that they commit. We've lived in Los Angeles long enough to know that too much violence takes place. I only live about 2 miles away from here. I know that too much violence takes place in the city. It's more than Mr. Guardado. It's more than Mr. Kizzy. Hundreds of people are murdered. Hundreds of people are killed. Hundreds of people are maimed by the police and the sheriffs in this city. And not just this city, but Long Beach and Santa Monica. Just name all of the cities. It goes on and on and on. And if we can't protest that, if we can't say no to that, then what kind of a society are we? And what does that part of the Constitution, and we heard read just a few moments ago, what does that mean? It means nothing at all. And so this arbitrary decision that the sheriff has made not to allow this march to move forward has to be resisted. We have to say no to it. Because this march needs to go on, and not just this march, but other marches. And the sheriffs cannot say no to that. The police cannot say no. It's not their job to do that. It's the job of the people to make the decision whether or not they're going to protest these fascist policies that our city and our county have followed for far too long. And so I want to make a call to all people of goodwill, to all people who want to stand up for justice, to all people who want to stand up for right. Sign this letter. Write the sheriff. Write the board of supervisors. Do whatever you have to do. Come out to press conferences to make sure that this decision is not allowed to take place.
You're here.
That this one act to consolidate the fascist role in this society is not going to be allowed to stand. That we can make one important stand for justice, knowing that other stands for justice are going to be required for us along the way. So I think that's probably all I need to say today. But indeed, as my brother said a moment ago, power to the people. Power to all of our siblings. We're fighting for what is right.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Reverend Frank Wolf. Now we'll hear the final statement from the press conference, activist Emmanuel Padilla.
So the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department's excuse for not granting permission to protest is as ridiculous as when they show up in military gear for a bunch of citizens with protest signs. We have seen time and again that the only manner they respond in is with violence and intimidation. When I was falsely charged and placed in jail last year on trumped up charges, it was clear that their intention was to intimidate all of the people of Los Angeles into backing down from any further protests against police brutality. But I nor any of my fellow protesters will be deterred from exercising our First Amendment rights. At times like these, I am reminded of the saying, all that is required for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. What can we as good people do when evil is protected by unjust laws and a badge? As civil rights icon John Lewis would say, get in good trouble. Thank you.
That was Emmanuel Padilla, and that was the press conference at the LA Sheriff Station in South Central Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Now let's hear the emergency appeal, read by Dolly Veal of the Emergency Campaign to Free Iran's Political Prisoners.
This is Dolly Veal, and I'm bringing to you today the emergency appeal, the lives of Iran's political prisoners hang in the balance, we must act now. A brutal campaign of arrests, torture, and executions is now taking place in Iran. This is an emergency. The lives and dignity of hundreds of political prisoners are in imminent mortal danger. All those who stand for justice and yearn for a better world must rally to the cause of freeing Iran's political prisoners now. Beginning in October 2020, the Islamic Republic of Iran launched a massive new wave of arbitrary arrests against labor, women's, and human rights activists. dissident intellectuals and artists, protesters and revolutionaries, and members of religious and oppressed minorities. Many are now being tortured, held in solitary confinement, and denied legal rights, assistance, or medical aid as the IRI attempts to force confessions, conduct sham trials, and carry out brutal floggings. Amnesty International warns of an alarming rise in executions, with 49 prisoners executed between December and February. This regime has a blood-stained record of attempting to violently crush any form of dissent and resistance, including sudden mass executions of political prisoners as happened in 1988. We cannot allow this to happen again. Importantly, this repression has been met with inspiring heroism. Many prisoners, their families, supporters, and various Iranian organizations have been speaking out and demanding freedom for all Iran's political prisoners at great risk to their own safety. The Iranian Writers Association has denounced the execution of prisoners of conscience, even as it is under extreme repression. Several members are imprisoned, including Arash Ganji, sentenced to 11 years for translating a book on the Kurdish struggle in Syria. Journalist and Defenders of Human Rights Center member Narges Mohammadi was imprisoned for 8.5 years. She is calling for protests against the solitary confinement of the two brothers of Navid Afkari, the Iranian wrestling champion, executed last year for being part of the 2018 mass rebellion. His brothers are sentenced to 54 and 27 years. The documentary film Nazreen, about imprisoned attorney Nazreen Sotoudeh, is an example of this nightmare of detentions and this implacable spirit of resistance. Iran's political prisoners face a dire, life-threatening, immediate emergency. Here are just a few other examples. A number of dual nationals from Europe, Australia, and the U.S. are being held in the political ward of the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. Amnesty International recently sent out urgent action alerts on two of these prisoners. Nahid Taghavi, rights activist, retired architect, and Iranian-German citizen, suffers from diabetes and hypertension. Her daughter, Marion Claren, reports that her mother was kept in solitary confinement for 151 days and was interrogated 80 different times for a total of 1,000 hours during her first 147 days of imprisonment. Nahid was released for a few weeks and then re-put into solitary confinement recently, and there are alerts from the Center for Human Rights in Iran about her deteriorating health condition. Same with Mehran Rauf. A British-Iranian citizen and labor rights activist is being held in prolonged solitary confinement, according to Amnesty. Rauf has been denied access to his own lawyers in England and has no immediate family in Iran, and his safety has not been verified for many months. Women prisoners are increasingly transferred to more remote prisons, limiting access by their family and lawyers. These include Sepeda Golian, a freelance journalist arrested for reporting and allegedly taking part in labor strikes. In early March 2021, she was suddenly transferred in chains from Tehran's Evin prison to Bushehr prison in southern Iran, more than 373 miles from her parents. Somaya Kargar, a Kurdish activist and philosophy graduate of Tabriz University, arbitrarily detained since October 16, was moved from Evin prison to the even filthier suburban prison of Karchak outside Tehran. The regime is refusing to allow her to receive scheduled medical treatments in Paris, which could save her from blindness. All of Iran's political prisoners must be unconditionally and immediately released. The government of the United States and Iran act from their national interests. And in this instance, we, the people of the U.S. and Iran, along with the people of the world, have our shared interests as part of getting to a better world, to unite to defend the political prisoners of Iran. In the U.S., we have a special responsibility to unite very broadly against this vile repression by the IRI and to actively oppose any war moves by the U.S. government that would bring even more unbearable suffering to the people of Iran. We demand to the Islamic Republic of Iran, free all political prisoners now. We say to the U.S. government, no threats or war moves against Iran. Lift U.S. sanctions. As to what you can do, you can go to the website, endorse and spread this emergency appeal, freeiranspoliticalprisonersnow.org.
That was the emergency appeal. The lives of Iran's political prisoners hang in the balance. We must act now. Next, we'll hear an interview with Maryam Claren, daughter of Nahid Taghavi, talking about her mother and the fight to free all of Iran's political prisoners. All right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Maryam Claren. And we're talking with Maryam about her fight to free her mother. And this is an extremely important thing. I want people to listen to it, and I want them to think about what's concentrated in all this. Maryam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this, because I want to get it, as I was saying, I want to get as much as I can about this. It's such an outrageous scene, and I know that it's something that's been, you know, has to have been chewing on you for quite some time. Tell us about your mom, and your mom's name is Nahid Taghavi?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So tell us about your mother, Nahid Taghavi. Who is she and what's happened to her, including very recently? But let's talk about that first to begin with.
My mother, Nahid Taghavi, is a 66-year-old retired architect, and she's a dual national, German-Iranian, and she is a political prisoner in the Islamic Republic of Iran. She was arbitrarily arrested on October 16, 2020 in her apartment in Tehran. Her German passport and other personal items were confiscated, and she's being held in the notorious Evin prison in solitary confinement in Iran. And yes, that happened about 6 months ago. Therefore, she's a political prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Now, just so people can be clear on this, how exactly did she end up going to prison?
That's a good question. My mom was communing between her two homelands, Germany and Iran, since many years. I think it was about 15 years. She was spending 5 to 6 months per year in Iran, 5 to 6 months per year in Germany. And the last time she went back to Iran was before the pandemic starts. And she used to come back in March 2020, but because of the coronavirus and the pandemic, she could not return. So we decided that she will come later. Then this cruel thing happened. She was arrested by the Revolutionary Guard in October.
So let's pursue this a little bit more, because, you know, when you're talking about all this, I keep thinking what the conditions are that she's facing in prison, which is, you know, it's not an area known for its welcome to the neighborhood, kids. It's actually it is something that has a long history of intense, what would you call it, going against people who don't necessarily feel, don't necessarily do the same thing or think the same way that the government thinks. Let's talk about that a little.
Exactly. The Evin prison, where my mom is right now, is a prison for political prisoners. There are only political prisoners in this prison, and it is very notorious, very well known on international level. And it is very famous because in the 80s, there were a lot of executions for political prisoners. I think in 1987, thousands of political prisoners were hanged at one day. It is very bad conditions in this prison. And this is what my mom is facing right now. And what makes it more cruel, she's there in solitary confinement in the very, very notorious isolation tract called 2A. And this isolation ward is under the control of the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard is a state in Iran. They control the whole system. They control the intelligence services. They control the military. They control a lot of economy things in Iran, and they don't have to give an answer to anybody in Iran. They only give an answer to the supreme leader. So she is there in this solitary confinement section, and the conditions are very, very poor in this section. For example, she is alone in a room which is about 2 meters long and 3 meters bright. I think bright is the correct wording, I hope. There are white walls, very high white walls. She has no pillow. She has no bed. She has to sleep on the stone floor. And every time when they took her out, for example, for a short break to have fresh air, it's about 20 minutes per day when she's allowed to go to the yard with a ward. She's never alone, and she's always blindfolded, so she cannot see anything, what's happening around her. And also the conditions, what they give the prisoners for eat and stuff like this. My mom told me that she hadn't had a fruit or vegetable or something like this during this 5 months. So she's getting weaker and weaker. Her skin is looking like leather. Her hair is falling down, and the whole conditions are very, very, very bad. So it's on every international law and every international agreement. It's unbearable what she's going through in this solitary confinement. And this is only about the conditions. When my mom was arrested, she was interrogated in 80 sessions, in total 1,000 hours, without an access to a lawyer, without telling us the charges, only her and the interrogators. So this is mental torture. There is the physical torture and there is the mental torture. And this is what my mom is going through since almost 6 months.
Now, when you started the campaign to free your mother, you raised you wanted to raise awareness about your mother's arrest. But that made you see that you were living in a bubble in a certain way. And, you know, you talk about coming to see how widespread the violations of human rights are in relation to this. Let's talk about that a little, because I think that's really important for people to see.
Yeah.
There's a particular attack on your mother, but there's also a wider attack on the people in general.
Exactly. The thing is, when my mom was arrested, the first thing that I knew I had to do is to raise awareness and to raise my voice and to tell the people of the world somebody is arbitrarily arrested on trumped up charges, and the world needs to know. And especially because she's dual national, I wanted the German government to take action and to secure her release. So I start researching. Researching what's going on in Iran. What's the problem? Why do they arrest people? And then, like you said, my bubble completely was damaged, because I saw that this is a very, very systematic human rights violation problem that we have in Iran. And this human rights violations have a history about 40 years since the Iranian Revolution, and systematic human rights violation in an unjust judicial system are commonplace in Iran. Lawyers, journalists, religious minorities, writers, artists are arbitrarily arrested. The prisoner is principally guilty. In custody, the only thing that counts is extorting evidence and confession. And these come from hours of interrogation, torture, and solitary confinement. The political prisoners are not allowed to receive legal counseling or visitors, and are exposed to the interrogation and torture methods without any protection. Once the so-called investigate pause is over, the prisoner still doesn't have access to a self-selected lawyer. The judiciary system wants the prisoners to take a lawyer who they trust, so there is no independent lawyers in Iran. And in unfair and secret kangaroo trials, the prisoners are sentenced to arbitrary prison terms, punishment methods such as flogging. The whole judiciary process is so unfair, is so unlawful under every international law or human rights convention. And it's the first thing is the reason why people get arrested, because they have another system of belief, because freedom of speech, because women who don't want to wear the forced hijab on their head, or lawyers who want to defend political prisoners, people who are protesting against the death penalty, they are all arbitrarily arrested. And then the whole judiciary process, which I described, gives them a high sentence and sometimes death sentence and like this. And the people of Iran are completely in this situation. And my mother's case is not an exception. She's even, I have the lucky thing is that she's a dual national. She has the German citizenship. And so I could make a lot of noise about her arrest. But I'm very sure if she was only an Iranian 66-year-old woman, if I would have told the media in Germany, for example, oh, my mom was arrested, nobody would cover it. But if you say, okay, there is a German-Iranian woman, the people start to cover it. And I really suffer for the people who don't have this voice. So I think it's very, very important to get awareness of this huge issue and problem of the political prisoners in Iran, and to let the people know.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me go back to something that you started to talk about, and I think it's really important. We're talking about these human rights violations, and you talk about that your mother was kept in solitary confinement for 151 days and was interrogated 80 different times for a total of 1,000 hours. And that was just during her first 147 days of imprisonment. Let's talk about that.
Yes, as I told you, that's only one part of the human rights violation. So she told us on the phone that she was interrogated 80 times, in total 1,000 hours. And I started to count and I thought, okay, this is about 13 hours every day, you know. You are completely alone. You are in this solitary confinement. You have no access to a lawyer. You don't know what is, are they allowed to do this to me? Nobody can tell you what's going on. She was even not allowed to call us. She only calls us after 12 days after her arrest, only to tell I'm alive. And then we did not hear anything from her about 1.5 months. So I would say the first 2 months, she was completely alone with her interrogator. And after that, she was also only allowed to call several times. And the cruelty does not stop. After the interrogation was finished, they kept her 2 months completely alone in solitary confinement. She was in a really, really bad condition because, you know, the interrogation was over. And you are sitting in this room and you don't know what's going on. Are they going to bring you to a trial tomorrow or next year? And you have no access to a newspaper or to anything. I did not hear the voice of my mom 5 months. And after 5 months, that was 4 weeks ago, they came and brought her finally to the public ward. The public ward of Evin prison is still a prison. It is still notorious. But if you are in solitary confinement 5 months, it means a lot to you in quality thing to have people around you. There are 38 other women who are all political prisoners, and they are lawyers environmentalists and like this. They talk to each other, and she was getting better. You know, we were still completely in our Free Nahid and Free All Political Prisoners work, but I was happy that she had people around her. And 3 days ago, on Monday, arbitrarily, she was taken back to solitary confinement after 20 days in public ward. And they are so cruel. They told her they are going to a doctor with her to make a blood test because she has diabetes. And she was going into the car. They brought her to solitary confinement, to the same section, as I told you, a few minutes before, and now she's in solitary confinement, and we have no clue why they brought her back. Is this a mind game? What is going on? This is torture.
Yeah, absolutely. Now tell me this, what kinds of things have you been doing to win her freedom?
After her arrest, I think it was 5 or 6 days after her arrest, I started the social media campaign Free Nahid, hashtag Free Nahid. I created a Twitter account for her. I created an Instagram account for her. And I started to talk with NGOs who are focusing on political prisoners. In Germany, there is one NGO called International Society of Human Rights, and of course, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. I told them about her arrest. They start to create a profile of her, and they also start to campaign and raise awareness of her case. Then the first media coverage started, and since then, today it's 171 days. I try to raise awareness about her case every day. I talk to German members of the parliament. I talk to the German government. I talk to NGOs. I'm in contact with a big number of families of other political prisoners and also to former political prisoners and so on and so on. I try every day my best to free her and to secure the release of all the other unjustly detained people.
Now, just let's just review something real quick, because I don't want people to forget this. You know, when you talk about this, what actually was it? I want people to think about this. What actually was the crime that your mother committed in the eyes of the government?
To be honest, we don't know what are the specific charges. Because, as I told you, we don't have an access. She don't have access to a lawyer, and that lawyer we have chosen for her has no access to the case. So we don't know what is really the charges. They are always ridiculous. The charges, they are nothing that we understand in our system of belief. For example, it's something like propaganda against the state. Propaganda against the state. So you are making advertising against the state. You and I, because I'm talking to you right now, this is in their eyes propaganda against the state, you know, because they don't accept freedom of speech or system of belief and in what you believe. The only thing my mom told her brother was, I'm an innocent person and I'm imprisoned because of my system of belief and because my freedom of speech. This is it. So what they are charging her exactly is uncertain. She is in a very uncertain step right now, you know, because I think we will know about her charges at the trial day, mm-hmm. Now, the sham trial day.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to dig into this a little bit more, too. In the beginning, you started to talk about this, and I wanted to try and see if you had any more to say about this, because I think it's also very, very important in relation to what's happening to your family, but also what's happening in general. You know, when you talk about what you've learned about the situation of political prisoners in Iran, I think it's really important, the kinds of things, you know, there's the kinds of things that you've been doing to help win her freedom. But there's also this whole other question of what have you learned about the situation of political prisoners in Iran in general?
I've learned that everybody who does not fit in their, I mean with their, in the regime's system of belief, is potentially an enemy and needs to be jailed. That is the first thing I've learned when I started to campaign for my mother's release, because I started to study the cases of other political prisoners, and it was so cruel and so confusing to me, because there is so many people and the charges are always something I don't understand, but they're so systematic. For example, there is a group of environmentalists. They were protecting the cheetah. Is it called cheetah? the something like a lion, a panther. Mm-hmm. And they were protecting this animal. That was their job. Eight young men and women. And they were always in the deserts of Iran and watching this cheetah, how this animal is drinking and doing this and doing that. They jailed them. These eight people were over a year in solitary confinement. These eight people went to a trial without a lawyer, and they were sentenced to 10 years, 6 years, 5 years, because they were protecting environment. You know, that has the most impact on me, this case, because I thought the government, who is arresting people who want to protect nature, what they are going to do with other people. And then you see other cases like Nasrin Sotoudeh. She's a very famous case. She's a human rights lawyer. She was advocating for political prisoners. They arrested her. She is sentenced to 33 years and 76 flogs. Because she was a human or she is a human rights lawyer, you know, and that shows me nobody is safe. You know, you are only safe if you completely fit, if you don't open your mouth. And the people in Iran are hungry. The people in Iran, the pandemic is so bad there. The people in Iran want to have work, and it's their right to go on the street and protest for their rights. But what the Iranian government does is, when they go on the street, they kill them on the streets. In November 2019, there were very famous November protests in Iran. 1,000 people were killed in the streets only because of protesting.
Now, you know, I have a couple more things I wanted to ask you. And, you know, you're talking about the situation of political prisoners in Iran. And it is, I think that's one area where people really do get, a lot of people get hit by that target. You know, they get hit in that, in terms of being looked at as, these are the people that are trying to bring down the regime. And, you know, and it could be somebody who's doing that or somebody who isn't doing that, but it is a way where the situation of political prisoners in Iran is sort of, you know, very, 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 it's like you're saying, it's a very tight schedule, and it impacts broadly in terms of whoever the government seems to think that it's, you know, it's the enemy. When you were talking about everything that you've been talking about, I was thinking about this thing that I know you have followed, or I don't know if you're part of it, but an emergency appeal, and it's an emergency campaign to free Iran's political prisoners. And I thought it would be really important for people to understand what that is. What does it mean, you know, that there is a battle to free Iran's political prisoners? Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. Exactly. There is an emergency appeal about the life of Iran political prisoners hang in the balance. You must act now. And I think that's very, very important. The emergency appeal comes from the U.S. People in the U.S. created it. And, you know, I even did not know about the struggle of political prisoners before my mom was arrested. There were sometimes headlines which I was reading, and I was thinking, oh my God, but then I go back to my ordinary life. So now that my mom is arrested and I've learned about all the struggle and all the problem from political prisoners, I think it's very, very important that we raise awareness about this big issue, and the people of the world need to know what is going on. People are getting arrested because of what they are thinking and so on. People are going through a very, very unfair judiciary system. People are sentenced to death. There are people sitting on death row in Iran, and nobody is talking about them. Iran has one of the highest numbers of executions in the world, you know, and I think that's a really, really big issue, and the struggle of the people in Iran and the world needs to know about that. So I appreciate a lot that there is an emergency appeal, I would appreciate it a lot if the people of the United States get aware of this problem.
So tell me this, where to now? What can people do? I think it's really important for people to understand. I mean, you're talking about a lot of very important things, including, you know, what you just said. I think it really does, and we could speak a little bit more on that. You know, the idea that people can't just sit back or say, well, yeah, I heard about that, you know, and then just go about their business. Because once you hear about something like that and the horror that's being unleashed in Iran against the people, then you have to actually take a step and you have to take a step and think, okay, well, one, who's backing this up? I mean, the U.S. is like, you know, also that they have a role in, you know, this whole development of these campaigns to, you know, go after people. But let's talk now about what you're thinking of in terms of the emergency campaign that I know you've had some familiarity with. But, you know, what drew you to sign that emergency appeal and join the emergency campaign to free Iran's political prisoners? And what's it going to mean?
First of all, I want to encourage everybody who is hearing my voice to be aware of this problem. And if my words were not clear enough, only putting in Google political prisoners in Iran, and then you can find a lot of articles and invest 10 minutes to learn more about it. And if you want to help, I encourage everybody to sign the emergency appeal to free Iran's political prisoners. It's very important because I think only if the pressure comes from the people, the governments will take action, will make moves. So I really would appreciate if everybody who's hearing my voice would invest a few minutes to learn about the political prisoners and to sign the emergency appeal, because their lives are really, really hanging in the balance.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mariam Claren, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to have people hear before we end this interview?
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks to everybody, to the audience who are hearing my voice. And I hope I could tell you a little bit about the struggle of political prisoners, and I would appreciate a lot if you all sign our emergency appeal.
All right. Thank you very much, Mariam, and thanks a lot for doing what you're doing and for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care now. That was Mariam Claren, the daughter of Nahid Taghavi. We'll have more to say about this situation next week, including the worldwide actions that are being taken. Meanwhile, to find out more or get involved, visit the site freeiranspoliticalprisonersnow.org. You'll find that link and more on my social media. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. Write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
Cats like me and you have got lost, but they adhere to laws outside the laws as they down.